They thought I was kind, thought I was healing. They clapped when I spoke about pain, hugged me when I comforted the broken. But they never saw the truth, that I wasn't offering affection. I was studying it, perfecting it. And the more they trusted me, the more dangerous I became. Because love, empathy, kindness, they're not protection, they're camouflage. And when used right, they don't open doors. They tear people apart. If you haven't already, make sure to follow us and tap the notification bell. We drop new content every day. Stay tuned so you never miss a story. Chapter 1, The Softest Weapon. You'd be surprised how far you can go in life by simply pretending to care. Not love, not empathy, not even basic decency, just the right facial expression, the right words at the right time, and most importantly, the right tone. I learned that affection was a language, not the honest kind, not the aching, soul-bearing kind, but the kind you could mimic, like a melody, a performance, an instrument you play softly enough that no one realizes they're the song. It started with a funeral, not mine, not anyone I truly cared about, a student, someone quiet, invisible, even in death, a girl named Marissa. She overdosed on something she shouldn't have even known how to pronounce. People whispered about bullying, whispered about her home, whispered as if whispering made them less guilty for not seeing her while she was alive. I didn't know her, not really, but I watched the way her name reshaped the school for a few days. The way guilt softened teachers' voices, the way students looked at one another, wondering who might be next. It was the perfect storm, not to exploit, to learn, to test the next frontier of control, emotional proximity. I started small, a hand on someone's shoulder after class, a whispered, "You okay?" in the hallway, not to friends, to people who weren't used to being noticed, people like Trevor, who had speech issues and never made eye contact, people like Jasmine, who sat alone at lunch and wrote violent poetry no one ever read. I didn't touch the popular ones. Not yet. They were still guarded, still performing for each other. No, this was the time to get close to the forgotten, because they needed it. They ached for it. And when you give someone who's starving a single bite of attention, they'll follow you anywhere. I remember the first time it really clicked. Jasmine had a panic attack in the girls' bathroom. I wasn't supposed to be there, obviously, but she didn't scream when I walked in, didn't push me away. She just collapsed into my chest, crying into my shirt, shaking like the world had just broken inside her. I wrapped my arms around her and whispered the perfect lie. "You're not alone." And in that moment, I felt her guard drop, felt her crumble. And I knew, this is power, not indominance, independence, the soft kind, the dangerous kind, the kind that makes people hand you their hearts, their secrets, their futures, and thank you for it. But something strange happened that night. After Jasmine had calmed down, after I had walked her to the nurse's office and returned to class, praised for stepping up and being a hero, I stood in front of the bathroom mirror and stared at the faint wet patch on my chest where she had cried. And for the first time in a long time, I asked myself, what if someone held me like that? What if someone whispered to me that I wasn't alone? What if I didn't have to perform to be cared for? It was a fleeting thought, one I buried immediately, because I knew what that question really was. Weakness. Wanting is weakness. Needing is a leash. And affection. Affection is the prettiest dagger in the drawer. I wiped my chest dry with paper towels, fixed my hair, smiled at the reflection, and walked back into the world like nothing had cracked. Because nothing had. Not really. Because I would never be the one needing the hug. I would be the one giving it. And in doing so, I would own everything. Chapter 2, Trust Exercises. There's a moment in every manipulation where you realize the game is scaling, where it stops being about one person, one win, one small gain. It becomes architecture, infrastructure, a map of influence so seamless no one even knows they're standing on a web until you tighten the threads. After Jasmine, after the bathroom breakdown, after the praise I didn't ask for but perfectly received, something in the atmosphere changed. Not just among the students, the faculty, the adults. They started seeing me differently. Empathetic. Emotionally mature. An old soul. God, they loved that one. It was like discovering a whole new tier of the game, and the gate was wide open. You have to understand something. Authority doesn't thrive on control. It thrives on perceived order. And nothing restores order faster than a teenager who knows how to nod at the right times, who speaks softly when others scream, who listens when others lie. So I became that. I became the safe student, the helper, the he's wise beyond his years kid. And they lapped it up like thirsty dogs. It started with Ms. Tillman, mid-30s, exhausted, recently divorced, though she tried to hide it behind oversized scarves and poetry lesson plans. I stayed after class one day, pretended I had a question about Whitman. I didn't. I just sat there and listened as she accidentally spilled pieces of herself between interpretations of metaphors. I used to love writing, she said, not looking at me. Before the grading, before the politics. I nodded, let the silence stretch. She didn't look at me, but she kept talking. When she finally met my eyes, I said, with just the right amount of hesitation, you still have that voice in you. You just don't trust it anymore. She blinked like I'd struck her. Paused. Softened. You're very perceptive, she whispered. Perceptive. That's how it always starts. Next came invitations to student panels, leadership groups, mentorship committees. Counselors praised me as a bridge between troubled kids and unreachable staff. I made teachers feel like they were finally understood. I made administrators feel like I was the future. They didn't know I was just mapping their weaknesses, logging their tells, scripting the emotional choreography of their responses. I became their confidant, and the higher I climbed, the more invisible I became. Because when you're the emotional favorite, no one questions your access. No one suspects the kid who remembers your birthday, the one who compliments your lesson plan, the one who sits in the front row and asks questions that make you feel seen. You start to get privileges, keys, passwords, blind trust. And with trust, doors open, files unlock, and people expose themselves, not because you forced them to, but because they wanted to. There's a kind of high you get when an adult confides in you like you're one of them. It's the moment you realize that age doesn't equal strength, that people in power are often more broken than the kids they lecture, that all it takes to undo them is kindness, strategic, targeted, weaponized kindness, the softest weapon of all. I once sat in the office of Vice Principal Harmon while he wiped tears from his eyes, talking about his alcoholic brother. He called me a remarkable young man, said I gave him hope, said I reminded him of who he used to be. All I had done was ask, what made you want to be a teacher in the first place? I walked out of that office with more than sympathy. I walked out with his Wi-Fi password, two master keys, and a favor I knew I'd cash in eventually. That's how you win wars no one sees. Not with fire. With feeling. Chapter 3. Beneath the applause. The first time the auditorium filled with applause, for me, I should have felt proud. I should have felt grateful. Moved even. But all I felt was calculation. Clapping hands. Shining eyes. Names I didn't bother remembering. Attached to people who suddenly wanted to shake mine. A standing ovation. A spotlight. A microphone that caught my voice just the way I rehearsed it in my bedroom the night before. Kindness is a ripple effect, I had said. One act of compassion can change the direction of someone's entire life. The irony. I didn't believe a fucking word of it. But they did. And that was the point. It started with a student leadership essay contest. Write something impactful. Emotional. Real. I wrote about my struggles growing up. About my silent battles with anxiety. About learning to find strength in softness. It was poetic, relatable, completely fabricated. They ate it up. I won the contest. Got asked to speak at assemblies. Counselors requested I mentor at-risk kids. Suddenly, I wasn't just trusted. I was celebrated. And there is no stronger camouflage than applause. You want to know the scariest kind of manipulator? Not the ones who threaten. Not the ones who bully. It's the ones who make you feel good about trusting them. The ones who make you think their rise is your win, too. That's what I became. The symbol. The success story. The polished example that the school could point to and say, see, the system works. They didn't know they'd just handed me the system's keys. Praise is seductive. It makes people generous. Lazy. Blind. My reputation became my armor. I didn't have to lie anymore. I just let people believe that I cared, that I was different. That I was the kind of student who would never do what I had already done 100 times behind closed doors. I manipulated test results. I accessed administrative folders. I rerouted punishments from kids I liked and doubled them for kids who annoyed me. And no one looked twice. Because I was a hero. and heroes don't need supervision. But here's the truth no one likes to admit. The better your mask, the more you forget what's underneath it. There were nights I sat in bed, staring at my ceiling, wondering if the fake versions of me were starting to overwrite the original. Was I still the scared kid who just wanted to disappear? Or had I become something worse? Someone who needed to be seen, just so he could be believed, and then used that belief like a loaded gun. There was a moment after one of my speeches, a teacher I barely knew hugged me, tears in her eyes. "You reminded me why I became an educator," she said. I smiled. I nodded. But in my head, I was rewriting her security questions. I was logging the names she dropped, her tone when she spoke about the principal, the cracks in her voice when she mentioned her divorce. Every conversation wasn't a connection. It was intel. And the applause? That was just the sound of doors unlocking. Chapter 4, Collateral Kindness. The thing no one tells you about kindness is that when it's fake, the damage it causes is real, worse than real, because no one's braced for it. No one suspects it. It's the kind of bullet that doesn't look like a weapon until it's already torn through something soft. I didn't mean to hurt Rachel. Not the way it happened. She wasn't a project. She wasn't weak or desperate or broken like the others. She was just kind. Dangerously kind. The kind of kind that doesn't come from trauma or survival. The kind that's genuine. And that made her valuable. At first, Rachel was part of the student wellness committee. She hosted mental health days, ran journaling groups after school, always wore little stickers on her sleeve with words like "breathe" and "you are enough." She reminded me of the girl I'd created in my contest essay. So I got close, not out of curiosity, out of strategy. If she was the school's bleeding heart, and I was its golden voice, then together, we'd be untouchable. I embedded myself like a virus into her circle, supported her events, co-hosted peer talks, even opened up to her about things that weren't true but sounded close enough to hurt. She adored me for it. "You don't just talk about healing," she said one afternoon. "You embody it." That word, embody, made my skin crawl. Because I knew I didn't. I was just playing the part. But still, I nodded. Still, I let her believe. It got out of hand fast. The attention. The joint projects. The way teachers leaned on us to lead the conversation. I watched her fall in love with the image. Not me. The idea of me. The soft, reformed boy who helped people. The reformed liar who stood in front of auditoriums and spoke about grief like it was a scar he carried instead of a weapon he'd sharpened. She kissed me one night after a wellness retreat, in the supply closet of all places. It should have felt like triumph, but it didn't. It felt like betrayal. Not hers, mine. Because when you fake kindness long enough, you forget who the real target is. And sometimes, the bullet doesn't hit the mark. Sometimes it ricochets. Rachel didn't find out about Jasmine directly. She overheard someone, two girls gossiping in the bathroom, laughing about how he comforted Jasmine the same way. How I used the same phrases, the same tone, the same carefully curated sadness. She confronted me behind the library, voice shaking, eyes glassy. "Was I just another case study to you?" I could have denied it. I almost did. But I saw something in her face I wasn't prepared for. She already knew the answer. She just needed me to say it. So I said nothing. And she broke. Right there in front of me. Silent sobs. The kind that doesn't beg for attention. The kind that happens when hope leaves quietly. Then she said something I didn't forget. "You're not helping people. You're harvesting them." She didn't report me. She didn't warn anyone. But she disappeared. From the wellness committee. From our joint sessions. From school. For nearly 2 weeks. The story was that she needed a mental break. But I knew better. I'd pushed her over the edge of her own kindness. And for what? A better reputation? More influence? A performance? That night, I stood in front of my bathroom mirror for over an hour. No bruises. No lies. Just a single question I couldn't get out of my head. How many people have I hollowed out, just to feel full? Chapter 5, The Smile That Lied. There's a difference between lying and becoming a lie. Lying is an act. A moment. It ends when you stop talking. But becoming a lie, that's slower. Heavier. It wraps itself around your bones, winds into your bloodstream, until every smile, every word, every second of silence is no longer yours. It's theirs. And that's where I found myself, days after Rachel disappeared, sitting in a guidance office, being praised for my emotional leadership. Smiling. that same soft, hollow smile. The one that said, "I'm here for everyone." The one that made teachers trust me, made students lean on me, made rooms bend around my presence. They called me authentic. They said I had the gift of making people feel safe. I wanted to laugh, but I didn't. Because the truth is, when you wear a lie long enough, it stops feeling like a costume. Rachel was gone, but the echoes weren't. Students still mentioned her in hallways, in soft tones, like she'd died. "She's just sensitive," someone whispered. "Too emotional," another said. And I stood in the middle of those whispers, untouched, unquestioned, elevated. It didn't matter what had really happened between us. What mattered was how I told the story. And I didn't even have to speak to tell it. I just had to keep smiling. That's when it hit me. Smiles are more powerful than secrets. Because secrets require protection. Smiles are weapons people invite. They disarm. They distract. They make people project their hopes onto your silence. A smile is a blank screen onto which the world paints what it needs to believe. And I became a screen so reflective, even I started to forget what was underneath. I tested it, started smiling more. To teachers, to students, to strangers. Warm, present, effortless. And they opened, confessed things, admitted things, trusted things. It was like pulling strings without moving your hands. I didn't have to manipulate anymore. I just had to exist. That was the ultimate evolution. Not just creating the illusion, becoming it. But late at night, when the school halls were empty and the applause was over, I'd sit in the reflection of a window, watching the faint curve of my mouth, and wonder, is this what I look like when I lie to myself? Because beneath the polished reputation, beneath the flawless control, there was a sliver of something else. Something that didn't smile. Something that still remembered Rachel's face. The crack in her voice. The way she said, "You're harvesting people." I brushed it away like smoke. Just another trace of emotion to cauterize. I had bigger games to play now. Rooms to command. Systems to hijack. People to mold. This wasn't about affection anymore. This was about scale. If I could control individuals with kindness, I could control entire rooms with belief. Entire schools with myth. Entire systems with presence. Bell final cliffhanger. Episode 3 ending. That night, I wrote a new rule. The more they praise you, the less they question you. And as I clicked off my desk lamp, as the world outside my window dissolved into silence, I whispered one last thing to the dark. It's not enough to be trusted anymore. It's time they start needing me. And the part of me that still remembered guilt, still remembered Jasmine, Mrs. Connolly, Rachel, that part, fell silent, because gods don't grieve. And I was done pretending to be human.